You're listening to the Bravehearted Voices podcast. In this podcast, we feature sermons that deeply stir us toward Jesus Christ and living fully for His glory. As you listen to this powerful collection of communicators from yesteryear, it is our desire that you be stirred to live a life fully given to Jesus Christ and discover a Christianity that actually works.
Again, we're looking at Matthew chapter 28, verse 16, specifically, which is the beginning of the Great Commission as he lays it out, and he gives us the first element of that commission in verse 16. I have to constantly force myself and remind myself in studying any passage to come back to the purpose for which the writer is writing, to see the overall view of what he's really trying to do and where he's going and the thrust that he really has. A writer didn't just throw some things together, you understand. It wasn't just some ideas he had, and they're a bunch of scattered ideas. It's not a bunch of oral tradition brought in from the past and kind of written down for us. That Matthew was writing with a specific purpose in mind. And if you're going to understand the passage, you have to see it under the umbrella of that one overwhelming thrust and the purpose that he's trying to accomplish. Of course, you know that Matthew is writing to the Jews, which narrows the whole thing down, doesn't it? Because we immediately know that we're going to have to think like a Jew. We're going to have to come in the context of the culture of Jesus' day. And we're going to have to see what he says in light of that culture and context. And of course, we know that he was writing to these Jews for a single purpose. And that was, he was an evangelist. I think that's why I like him so much. He was an evangelist. He wanted to win the Jews to God. Oh, if he could just sweep them into the kingdom. If they could just see that Jesus really was and is the kingly Messiah. And he just desperately wants to convince them of that. It's interesting that he acts like a lawyer. He just begins to stack up the evidence, man. Page after page, paragraph after paragraph. Just lays that thing out and says, hey, you've got to be convinced. If you see this evidence at all, you've got to be convinced. Jesus Christ was and is the kingly Messiah. Of course, you understand that one of his strong emphases throughout the entirety of the book to get that done is this fact that Jesus is King of the kingdom. In fact, he tells the parables of the kingdom in Matthew chapter 13. Oh, there's seven of them. And what's it all about? Every single parable presents Jesus Christ as King of the kingdom. He is in charge. Matthew shows Jesus getting done with the Sermon on the Mount, chapters 5, 6, and 7. And the minute he gets done, he rolls up his sleeves and man, he hits the streets. Chapter 8 and 9 are the action chapters. And Jesus is all over the place. He marches into every single area of life and conquers that thing. He deals with demons. He deals with nature. He deals with physical bodies. He just touches bodies and they're healed. He speaks the word and things take place. Man, he calms the sea. He even forgives sin in chapter 9. He just walks into every area of life and comes out clean. He conquers. Jesus is authoritative, you see. He's King of the kingdom. And everything comes under his thumbprint. But there's a strange twist in all of this as you get into his writings. Just amazing. You just stand back and say, what on earth is the man doing? Because he keeps talking about this cross thing, you know? He keeps talking about Jesus is going to die on a cross. He keeps coming back to that all the time. In fact, half of the chapters of the book of Matthew are dedicated to the subject of the cross. And you see that, if you see it as I see it, it's a strange twist. Because how, if he's trying to present Jesus Christ as the kingly Messiah and in authority and in charge, how do you get that out of a cross, brother? You look at that and say, man, they whipped him this time. You look at the cross and say, oh, he's defeated this time. You look at the cross and say, well, he didn't come out clean this time. I mean, this is a total wipeout. But that's the strange twist to the kingdom, you see. The strange twist to the kingdom is the way up is down. The way in is out. The way to live is to die. The way to win is to lose. The way to live is to die. That's what's going on here. And if you want to reign, you know how you reign? You reign from a tree. And he shows Jesus as conquering, and the reason he's conquering is slap dab in the middle of this cross and all of its style as he just constantly pours his life out, gives himself away, gives himself up for the lives of others. That the whole thrust of redemptive process just keeps bounding through his book as he shows Jesus just giving himself away. It's a cross and he's King of the kingdom. And do you know why? He reigns in authority. And do you know why? Because he reigns from a cross. It's all about this cross and its overwhelming style. So the cross does not nullify his rulership. It verifies it. See, this is not a Jesus who's being conquered. He's conquering. He's not defeated. He's not a victim. He's a victor. That's this. This cross is not an oh my. This cross is a whoopee. We win. See, that's what this cross is all about. And he shows that in this book. My, it's the overwhelming theme. Now, you're not surprised then that he comes to the climax of the book. I'm talking the last five verses. And would you expect him to drop that theme? No, no, no. He's been building this all along. And can you see Jesus? He's gone through the crucifixion event. He's been living the cross style before the lives of his disciples. Gone through the crucifixion event. He's conquered death now in resurrection style. And he marches right into his disciples and says, come on, guys. We're going to just keep at it. We're just going to keep pouring our lives out. And the cross style is not a past thing. Wipe your hands. It's over now. It's a present thing. Come on, guys. Let's get with it. We're going to pour our lives out. And he calls them to the mission. We might call it the cross-style mission of pouring your life out, winning your world. Let's get with it. Go and make disciples of all nations. So he gives them the overwhelming mission at the climax of this book. Now, you understand the mission is not new then. This is not, oh my, now we're ready to start on a mission. It's not that kind of a deal. See, the mission has been throbbing in the heart of God all of this time. It's been present. Why, it was present back before the foundation of the world. For in the heart and mind of God, Jesus died on a cross before eternity, before the foundation of the world. So this whole business of pour your life out and win your world and be redemptive is not some kind of new deal. See, it thundered through the Old Testament. It's interesting to go to the Old Testament and find the places where the cross just shows itself just plain as day. See, this is not a new deal. This business of pour your life out, give yourself up, redemption, the act of God. It's all over the Old Testament. Don't have time to give the illustrations of it. You thunder in the New Testament. Jesus is living the style. You see the cross in evidence, in the physical form. Hey, it's all about this style that's before the foundation of the world, through the Old Testament, through the New Testament, and it's here in this hour. So this is not a new deal, because you see, this mission, the pour your life out thing, is the nature of the kingdom. See, it's the nature of the kingdom. It's not something foreign that's been pressed upon us and a task we got to do. See, I want you to be sure and see that the mission he's giving us is not task-oriented. Well, it's hard for us to think in terms of something to do without being task-oriented. See, there's not a quota to meet. It's not, oh, we got this job to do. Okay, Jesus assigned us. Let's strategize. How are we going to get it done? And finally, when we accomplish the task, we wipe our hands and say, that's over. Do you understand? If every single person in the whole world was Christian in this moment, we would still be called to this mission, because this is the mission which is the nature of the kingdom of God, which is all about pour your life out. And it's not task-oriented. You don't meet a quota and wipe your hands and finish. It's the very essence of who you are. In fact, he's calling us to respond to the very nature of the person of God who's come to live within us. And we're responding to the nature of the kingdom itself. Now he thunders into the last five verses of this book, chapter 28, verse 16 through 20. And he gives the mission. And each one of these verses is an element of the mission. And the danger is that you get so wrapped up in the elements that you don't see the whole, which is the mission, which is the pour your life out thing. So we don't want to do that, but we do want to analyze the elements, and we're analyzing one tonight, and it's verse 16. And it's the element of surrender. Now, you know, just to remind you that verse 16 and 17 are intimately linked, because verse 16 is surrender, which is the atmosphere of the mission. And verse 17 is submission, which is the attitude of the mission. So the attitude of the surrender is found in verse 17, which is the submission, the worship thing. So just a reminder, we're looking at the element of surrender. Verse 16. Then the 11 disciples went away into Galilee to the mountain which Jesus had appointed for them. Surrender. Now, there's no question as you look at verse 16 that surrender is implied in the fact that the disciples show up where they're supposed to be. See, the reason they got in on this commission, the reason they got in on this whole deal is because they obeyed, listened to, came through, showed up where they're supposed to be. This is an announced appearance of Jesus, and they were appointed to be there, and they surrendered to that. And don't think it was some light surrender. It wasn't just a Sunday morning all dressed up, make a little trip into the altar, shake the preacher's hand deal. See, it was a lot bigger than that. Hey, they had to pack their bags. They had to go 80 to 100 miles, walk 7 solid days. They came here on purpose, son. They had destiny in mind when they pulled this one off. See, when they came here, this was all about surrender because they had made plans to start their fishing business again. Now they had to dump all those plans, you know, and they're coming to receive the Great Commission. See, when they came here, this was all about surrender. They had already surrendered by the time they came to this place, and implied in this very showing up where they're supposed to be is the idea of surrender. So surrender is vividly now played out in the life of the disciples. They did not get in on the first resurrection appearance of Jesus because they didn't show up. They did not get in on the shaking of the ground and the appearance of the angel because they didn't show up there. But now they're in surrender and they have come to the appointed place. Let me discuss surrender with you for just a moment. I have some real concerns about the whole concept of surrender. And I know all of our lives we've heard preachers preaching on surrender, and we're used to that terminology, surrender. But I have a real fear lest we should dilute and dilute the concept of surrender. There would be a variety of ways to do it, you know. And I suppose the chief concern I have in this hour that's really been pressing upon me in these months is that we would water down the concept of surrender by making it and thinking of it in terms of items or things or stuff. In other words, when we think of surrender, what do we think of? Well, I've got some things I really need to surrender to Jesus. What is it in your life you need to surrender? Oh, there's that item. Then there's this. Oh, yeah. And then there's that. Oh, I should surrender that too. And we begin to think of surrender in terms of things, of items, of stuff that we hand to Him. Now, when you think of surrender in those terms, it immediately raises some obvious questions. To me, at least. One question is, well, how much do I actually have to surrender to Jesus to be a Christian? If I'm surrendering things, if there's this item, that item, if I got 4 items in my life, then how many of those items do I have to surrender in order to be a Christian? So what is surrender when it comes right down to its bare definition? How many of those items do I have to give? Oh, you ought to give all. Well, that's 100%. So you're saying that I have to surrender all 4 items to Jesus if there's 4 items in my life. Well, if you're going to be 100% Christian, but that's so radical. Who could do that? I mean, could you actually surrender all 4 items? I mean, suppose there's 8. Boy, that really complicates it. Suppose there's 16 items. Whoa. Suppose there's 36. Oh, good night. What are we into here? All these items that I got to surrender. I don't know if I can do that. And see, it really gets complicated when you talk about surrender in terms of items to surrender. So how could you be 100% surrendered and give 100% of the items? Well, that's way beyond my... I can't even fathom that. So what I think I'll do is I'll just be 75% Christian. That's it. I'll just give 3/4 of my items. So I got 4 items in my life. I'll give 3 of them and keep 1 for myself. Maybe I could live with that. Or maybe I won't even do that, see? Could I still be Christian if I gave... If I was 50% surrendered? That's it. 50... Would that be neat? Then I could keep 2 items for myself and give 2 items to Jesus. And that way I'd be Christian, but I wouldn't be really surrendered Christian. But I wouldn't be surrendered. Well, I'd be half surrendered. See, what can I get by with here? If I think of surrender in terms of items, then I begin to think in those terms. How many items do I have to surrender to be a Christian? And when do I cease to be one? And when am I really one? And what are the items I really have to surrender? And can I be 3/4 surrendered? Or maybe it isn't that way at all. Maybe you don't surrender out of 4 items. Maybe you don't surrender 3. Maybe you don't surrender 2. Maybe it's not that way. Maybe what you do is you surrender all the items half the time. Or 3/4 of the time. Then I would be 3/4 surrendered because I surrender all the items of my life to Jesus, but I only surrender them half the time. I go to church half the time. I tithe half the time. I'm honest half the time. I'm moral half the time. See, it's just half, all the items to Jesus half the time. Maybe that's the way it is. Because you're thinking in terms of items to surrender. things. This, this, that, the other. Ladies and gentlemen, you have missed the point if you think in those terms. See, you got to dismiss that thing from your brain. I know we evangelists have been guilty of teaching you that, because we really got on your case about certain items and we wanted you to come to the altar and surrender those things. So you got the idea that's what surrender was all about. But I'm trying to help you reverse your thinking, because surrendering to Jesus is not about surrendering items. See, surrender to Christ is about relationship. See, you can give up all your money and still not be surrendered to Jesus. You can give up all your time, still not be surrendered to Jesus, man. See, you can become a missionary and still not be surrendered to Jesus, man. Because this is not about surrendering things. This is about the dynamic of relationship, which is fluid and moving and somehow coming into intimate relationship with Christ, whereby He becomes Lord. And you see, lordship is not about, okay, you can be Lord over that. Lordship is about a relationship you have with Him, whereby you are under His authority, and somehow He's moving in a daily basis, and you're sensitive to His movement, and somehow He's structured the thing and you're fitting into that structure, and He's moving you where He wants to move you, and it's happening on a moment-by-moment basis. And it's not about things that I surrendered. It's about Him and me and getting together in this flow of the divine life of God in and out of your life. So when you talk in terms of things, you have missed the whole point of what He's trying to talk to us about. Surrender is about relationship. Now you see this distinctly played out in the lives of the disciples in verse 16. Surrender being relationship. Number one, start with this. They were listening. Oh yeah. They were listening. Well, where do you find that, preacher? Oh, it's the first word in my translation. Don't know what your translation says, but verse 16, then, stop right there. You know what He's telling you? They're listening. Oh, let me explain that to you. Then, or even a better translation would be the word but. It's a conjunction. And anytime we use the word but as a conjunction, we use it to paint this picture over here and then paint this picture over here. And when we get done with this picture, we say but, and then this picture flows out. That's exactly what He's doing. He says, let me give you this overwhelming picture. And what is painted before we get to verse 16 is from verse 11 down through verse 15, which is all about the Sanhedrin's deception and the big lie, spread the rumor around that Jesus' body was stolen by the disciples. That's what the world is talking about. That's what they're saying. But the disciples went to Galilee. The kingdom is proposing a whole other deal. The Sanhedrin, in their deception and in their ungodliness, is spilling out this picture, but the kingdom is spilling out this picture. The ungodly Pharisees are talking about, hey, the disciples stole the body, but we're going to see Him at the mountain. See, the ungodly leadership of Israel is saying, hey, He's dead, He's not alive, the whole thing's a fake, but we're going to visit Him, and the kingdom of God is alive because He's alive. And it comes down to who you're going to listen to. What voice is going to get your ear? Are you going to listen to this group over here? Are you going to listen to the kingdom of God? Are you going to fall in line with the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the Sanhedrin and their false reports and listen to them? Or are you going to go to Galilee, brother? And are you going to listen to the voice of Christ and see Him as He is? See, it comes right down to bottom line stuff. Who on earth are you going to listen to? Now, you know, that is characteristic of life. Who are you going to listen to? In fact, every decision you make, you may think you're a self-starter, and yet you think up everything yourself, and you don't have to listen to anybody. But brother, when it comes down to it, every decision you make is who you're going to listen to. Because there's all these voices coming at you, and the world is constantly bombarding us with all this stuff. And man, how do I know? I've never been here before. I don't know how to raise a family, and I got 50 million people telling me how to do it. And I got all these books at the Christian bookstore yelling at me, telling me exactly how to discipline my kids. And I got the radio blaring at me. And everybody's an expert on this thing except me. And I'm here and I've never done this and I don't know what to do. And it all comes down to who am I going to listen to? And you see, the view of the world is always more attractive because it caters to my selfishness. It allows me to, the world is more tolerant towards me and allows me bigger parameters. It's not as narrow, you understand, and I can get by with more and not as much as required of me. So the voice of the world is really appealing. Who am I going to listen to? And when you come over to the call of Christ, see, it's all about pack your bags, man, and go to Galilee. Oh, 7 days. Yeah, no motels. That's right. Just hit it, son. Go to Galilee. And when you get there, I'm going to spin you out and spill you out to a world. In fact, what's going to happen is the call of Christ is going to be so absolutely radical that we're going to talk about it in terms of death. Now, that's really appealing, isn't it? The world says, come and live. And the call of Christ says, go, come and die. See, the world screams, we want to give you life at its fullest. We want to fulfill you. And the kingdom of God says, hey, lose yourself and give yourself up. And talks about crucifixion. And it all boils down to, who am I going to listen to? Who am I going to listen to? It's really interesting when you come to the Word of God. There's several Greek words that are translated in our translation, English translations. They're translated into the word obedience. One of them. One of those words. In fact, this word that I'm talking about is used 23 times in the New Testament. And you know what it means? To listen to. So obedience means to listen to. Hey, why don't you just start listening to Jesus? Now, you understand, it's not listen to in fact of get information. That's not the listen to he's talking about. No, the whole concept is bigger than that. Because, well, let me give you an example of where it's used. Ephesians 6:1. Children, obey your parents. You know what that word says? Children, listen to your parents. Children, listen to, pay attention to, come under the influence of, honor and respect the opinion of, take the advice of, listen to, come under the control of. See, the whole thing is bigger than just doing certain things that are told to you to do. The whole thing is, will you come under the authority of and listen to? See, who's going to get your ear? See, who are you going to think like? See, who's going to influence you that you're going to walk day after day and it isn't, well, I surrendered that and I surrendered. No, no, no. See, this is day after day after day walking in the Spirit of God, listening sensitive to His voice until He moves you and you fluctuate with the movement of the divine God in your life because you are in a state of constantly straining to listen to His movements, to feel His touch and come under His authority and be moved by His influence. And this is where you are. See, that's this word here. Who has your ear? The disciples are listening to. Now, there's a second part of this surrender concept given in this verse. They were listening. But secondly, they were liable. Yeah, verse 16 again. Then the 11 disciples. That really intrigued me. 11 disciples. In fact, I couldn't get away from it. 11 disciples. In fact, to tell you the truth, that haunted me for weeks. 11 disciples. Then the 11 disciples. Matthew is so specific about that. Then the 11 disciples. Not 12. Not 5. Not the 11 disciples plus the women. The 11 disciples, and then he double emphasizes it, you'll notice, because at the end of the verse he says, then the 11 disciples went away into Galilee to the mountain which Jesus had appointed for them. Like this whole deal is just about these 11 disciples, and this mountain was specifically appointed just for them, 11 disciples. Now, maybe you don't get the significance of that, but let me remind you that if you go to your commentary, most Bible scholars will tell you that this resurrection appearance right here that we're dealing with in verse 16, this resurrection appearance was probably the time when the 500, more than 500 disciples saw Him all at one time. Oh, Paul gives that to us, you know. Paul in 1 Corinthians 15:6 says, after that, Jesus was seen by over 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remains to this present day. So before Jesus left this world in his ascension, he appeared to over 500 disciples all at the same time, which I think is really neat, because you can get 11 disciples seeing him, but they might be on pills. But 500 all at the same time, you're really stretching it, man. When 500 lay their eyes on him, when 500 come and walk away and say, yeah, we saw it. When 500, see, that's really verification. So there was a time before Jesus was ascended that over 500 disciples got involved in his resurrection presence. And most Bible scholars say, when did that appearance take place? This is it, right here, right here. Now, that makes sense. The reason that makes sense is because this particular physical appearance of the resurrected Jesus is the only time that it was prior announced that he was going to show up. See, all the other appearances were unannounced. He just kind of showed up, and we said, whoa, how'd this happen? See, the disciples were sitting in the room, and all of a sudden, wham, he passed through the walls and appeared. Well, we certainly didn't plan on this. See, the Emmaus Road scene, two men walking along. Who would have dreamed that a resurrected Christ would join them at that moment? They weren't planning on this. They weren't looking for this at all. Oh, the garden scene, when Jesus appeared to the ladies. That was a startling thing, because they weren't planning on that. But this appearance of Jesus was announced. In fact, you can go back to chapter 26, verse 32, where they're coming down from the Mount, they're coming down the Mount of Olives, out of the upper room. This is before the crucifixion. And Jesus turns to his disciples in verse 32 of chapter 26 and says, after I have been raised, I'm going to go before you to Galilee and meet you there. So he told them this, made an appointment with them a long time before, well, not a long time, but several days before his crucifixion. Then the angel appeared and told the ladies, now go tell the guys that such and such a time, at such and such a mountain, Jesus wants to meet him in Galilee. Then the women ran headlong into Jesus, and Jesus told the ladies, now go tell the guys, such and such a time, such and such a place, I want to meet him in Galilee. So this was an appointed time. Now, you know good and well that if the ladies found out about this, Mary Magdalene, the other Mary, if the ladies found out about this, you couldn't keep them away from there. They're going to see the resurrected Christ every time they get a chance. And if he's going to show up in Galilee, they're going to be there. So you just know that those ladies were here at this scene. Come on, if this was spread around the Christian community, hey, in 1 week, 2 p.m., such and such a mountain, Jesus is going to show up. We've seen him several times, and he's going to meet us there. Hey, you know that they'd come out just to see if it's all the truth. So it all makes sense that this probably was the time that over 500 disciples saw Jesus. So what does that have to do with this? Oh, why doesn't Matthew say that? He ignores that whole thing. Then the 11 disciples. He doesn't talk about 500 disciples. The 11 disciples. And this mountain was appointed for them. And they are zeroed in on. It's like nobody else counts except them. It's like they're the whole deal. When there were 500 other disciples around, couldn't he have at least mentioned them? Why is he so specific about the 11 disciples? I'll tell you why. Because it doesn't matter how many disciples are there. It doesn't matter whether there's 1 million disciples, 500,000 disciples, 5,000 disciples, whether there's 20 disciples. These 11 disciples have a specific call and a specific destiny, and they have been singled out, and they have been called by God, and they have responsibility in their hands, and they are liable for what's going to take place in the days ahead. And there's no way for these 11 boys to shake their shoulders and say, well, I'm only one. Look at all these other guys. Hey, it wasn't my fault. I was just there. There's no way they're going to get by with that, see? Because they've been handpicked by God, and they are liable and responsible for the flow of the life of God into the book of Acts and the establishment of the church itself. Oh, you know where I'm going with this, don't you? Could I tell you that that is true with you? Well, we got 300 in our church and I'm only one member. Doesn't matter how many members you've got, brother. I'm telling you, your name is in the book, and you're on the docket, son. And I'm telling you, you are liable, and you are responsible, and God has specifically singled you out and made an appointment for you. You can't say, well, I'm not good looking. We know you're not, but neither were these guys. Because that has nothing to do with it. And we understand, well, I haven't got the education. Listen, they were unlearned and ignorant men too. And yet they wrote the book that's the most read in the world. Which gives me courage. These boys are liable. And see, there's no way just to shake you, to blend in with the crowd and to act like you're just one of them. And see, no, no, no. Your name is in bright lights tonight. And it's as if you're here all by yourself. And that the whole dynamic of, could you feel this? The whole dynamic of the kingdom of God and its success in this community is in your hands, man. I really get tickled about the church. You know, when things are going well down at the church, we say, oh, yeah, we're doing, we built, we did, we use that kind of language. Then when things get a little shaky down there, it's, well, they built, they did, they... And our language changes. And we disassociate ourselves. And we're no longer a... But see, you can't get by with that here. See, you are the only one in the place, man. It's not 500 disciples here. It's one disciple and it's you. And your name's on the line. And you are responsible. Am I yelling at you? Probably. You are responsible for this. And you cannot shirk this. You can't wipe your hands of this. You can't say, it's none of my business. I'm only one among many. No, you are the one. Because God has singled you out. And He's called you. Now that's not a downer, that's an upper for me. Whew, God has picked me out. Yes. Whoa, isn't that encouraging? He selected me. He believes in me. God believes in you. God died for you. Oh, you know the old statements. If you were the only one in the whole world, Christ would have died for you. If you were the only one in the whole world, friend, He selected you. You have been picked out, chosen by God from before the foundation of the world. And He has single-handedly selected you for this moment. Wow. So you see, the disciples are listening. The disciples are liable. Oh, but lastly, they are led, or they are being led. Oh yeah, it's in verse 16. We're talking about surrender, the elements of surrender. Then the 11 disciples, they're liable, went away into Galilee to the mountain which Jesus had appointed for them. Wow, I love those words. Appointed for them. This is a divine appointment. Again, there had been a lot of appearances of Jesus Christ. You understand? Oh, He came and joined these two guys on the Emmaus Road. But on the Emmaus Road, you know, He did not give any kind of final word. Oh, He opened up the Scriptures to them. They went away saying, our hearts are burning within us. But when it came right down to it, this was not a final announcement. This was not a final word. This is not laying on you, brother. Oh, Jesus came, passed through the walls, and there's 10 disciples there. He sat down at the table and ate with them. And again, He revealed Himself to them. And there was a convincing factor in that, you understand. But hey, it was not like, this is the final word, brother. I'm laying it out to you. Oh, you understand, He came back when Thomas was there and the 11, and he showed them His hands and His side. And yes, Thomas fell down, and there was great revelation that came out of all that. But see, there was no, this is the final word, brother. No, He's made an appointment with them. Selected a time, selected a place, He's shown up, they've come, and it's here that He's going to announce the final word. And what is the final word? It's in the divine appointment, right here in the Great Commission. Hey, this is the final word. And suddenly the disciples are not in flux anymore. The disciples are not wandering around, wondering where to go anymore. Suddenly the disciples are all wrapped up in what we call destiny. And they've got a focus. Isn't it interesting, in the final word, these last five verses, He gives nothing about a flow chart for the organization of the church. Nothing. Now, should we have general superintendents, or should we have VSs, and should we have general board, and should we, and how should the church be? And he says, I don't give a rip, just go do it. See, there's no word about that in here at all. That's not in the final word. Really interesting. Because we'd like to have some kind of organizational structure to the church that's biblical. But it's really, you're hard-pressed to find it. It's very interesting that in the final word, he doesn't give you anything about architectural structure of the church. He doesn't draw out a plan for church buildings. And everybody, wouldn't that have been neat? Here's the church, here's the way you build a church. Every church has blue carpet with blue padded pews. See, and this is the way it is, and it's always in a fan shape, and every church you go, whoop, this is like McDonald's, we're all alike. See, and everybody would have the same, but see, it's not that way at all. There is nothing said here about church structure buildings. In the final word. Not in the final word. See, he doesn't give anything in the final word here about Sunday school and when you should have it. And, oh, don't have Sunday school at night. No. That's not biblical. See, there's nothing about night, morning. In fact, Sunday school isn't even mentioned. It wasn't even invented till about 1850. So, see, there's nothing about Sunday school in the final word. But what is the final word? What's clarified? What does he come? Last appointment. Here he is, set the whole thing up, making his final appearance to the disciples, looking them right in the eye and say, I want to give a final word. I want to give a clarity. I want to spell it out, brother. I want to lay it out. The one thing that I want you to know above all other things, you got to be clear on this. And it's all about the mission. The mission. The mission. And they go out of there pure, clear. I mean, they know there's no confusion about what God has called them to do. It's laid out. And they walk out of there with a destiny in their bones.
Well, you know where I'm going with this, don't you?
Wow. That's exactly what he wants to do with us. See, I'm really concerned. Oh, not you folks, but other places I go. I'm really concerned about the whole, we seem to be kind of in limbo. See, I get up on Monday morning and I get the kids ready to school and man, help my wife get them off and well, and then I get in the car and I beat the traffic and I get down to my job and I work like a dog and I come home and I'm tired and then we got this and then we got the PTA and then the church deal and then I got the committee meeting and then the next day and the next day and the next day and finally I come on Sunday morning, I'm totally exhausted, man, and I flop down on the pew and say, woo, I'm glad it's padded, and I just sit here kind of, oh, and then the pastor gets up and spits and fumes and yells at me and says, did God use your life this week? And I say, I don't know. Did he? Didn't he? Well, I don't know. I wanted him to. But I got involved in, and I was down there, and then I went over, and I know, I hope, a problem, maybe, oh, did he? I hope so. I want him to. I don't know if he did. Well, I'm just believing that he did. And if God used me this week, it was accidental. I can see you're not identifying with this at all. It's accidental. And I have no idea whether he did or whether he didn't, and I wanted him to, but I don't. I got so much going on, and there's just a, and it's a, and I'm in. We got to get out of that.
Amen. That's right.
See, that can't be. Now, if you want to be wishy-washy and accidental in church building, fine. If you want to be wishy-washy and accidental and, whoa, I don't know, and did we, and no, I don't know, and general superintendents, and no general, what, and DSs, and no, I don't know, how we got, I don't care about that. But brother, when it comes down to the mission, when it comes down to the one single thing that God has made so absolutely plain, we can't be accidental, this can't be limbo. See, this somehow's got to ring with destiny, and it bothers me that our people don't somehow have this overwhelming sense of destiny, and we've been sent and we've been called and God has put his thumb in my back, and I'm not clear on a lot of things, but I'll tell you, I'm clear on one thing. God has called me to win my world, and I'm at it. He has sent me. And I want to ask you tonight, do you have this sense of destiny? Well, preacher, how can I have this sense of destiny? Surrender. Listen to him. Listen to him.
Not just surrender some things. No, it's come under his influence. Hey, let your ear. He wants your ear, man. Until moment by moment you become sensitive to his movement and his voice, and you're listening to him, and he's influencing you, and he's all over you, and day by day you're moving in the flow of this thing, and you realize the overwhelming sense that you are liable, that he's called your name out, brother, and there may be a million disciples around, but brother, yours is on the dotted line, and somehow you have an overwhelming responsibility in this thing, and you begin to roll with destiny. Well, yeah, we need a few people to have that. They can be the wild-eyed evangelists who sweat a lot. But see, the New Testament says that's the scene of every one who names his name. Jesus, am I going to listen to you? Yeah, I guess I'd have to start there, wouldn't I? With this whole thing, I'd have to start there. Listening to you. See, God, there's so many voices. There's so much going on. I'm not bad. I'm just distracted, God. I've just been sucked into my world, and so much is happening, and there's just, and in the midst, and it isn't that you want me to quit all that. It's in the midst of all of that. Could I give you my ear? Could somehow I hear your voice? Could somehow I come under your influence? It's not I'm going to quit my job. It's that somehow in the midst of my job, I would be in the position of being listening to, obedient, surrendered, listening. I want a relationship with you tonight, Jesus. I'm sick of you bringing you things. I'm not bringing you my money tonight. I'm not bringing you my time tonight. I'm not bringing you my family tonight. I'm not bringing you my future tonight. Jesus, I'm bringing you myself. That somehow we might enter into intimate relationship, and I would be able to listen to you, because I realize you have selected me and put my name in the book, and I am responsible. And I want you to clear the fog out of my brain, God. I want you to give me clear cut. I want you to give me clear insight. I want you to give me clear call. I want to see it plain as day. I want you to clear the smog out of my brain. And I want you to give me no longer limbo, not being used by accident, but down to an overwhelming destiny that I am yours and you are pouring your light through me to change my world. Heads are bowed. You open to this? I'm asking you to listen. I know you've tried to surrender a lot of things to Jesus. Okay, let's get off that. Would you just come, present yourself to listen? Jesus, I'm going to listen to you. I'm bringing my life under your influence, moment by moment under your influence. I'm releasing myself to you into intimate relationship with you. I'm listening. I give you the right to move me. And please burn through my soul in overwhelming destiny. In clarity of call. In a sense that your will is spilling through me. You open to that tonight? Dear friend, I don't know how you survive without that. I'd blow my brains out if I didn't have destiny. There's too many things happening at me. There's too much pressure if you don't have some kind of direction, some sense, some focus, some overwhelming compulsion, some destiny, some call of God, if you don't see. Dad, do you realize this is what your kids need from you? They need to sense from you that while there may be a million disciples around, God has handpicked you, and that you, Dad, are focused, and they can see what it is that for a man of God to be locked into destiny in Jesus. Grandpa, do you know that your grandkids, they need to see that in you?
Our altar's open. I want to invite you to slip out of your seat and kneel here. It's not about good and bad. Come on, get off that. It's not about surrendering some things. Come on, we're done with that. This is about listening. Coming into relationship of lordship. And walking out of this place tonight, not accidentally being used by Him, but with a sense of amazing destiny, because your name has been selected and He has plugged you as a key individual into His divine plan. You want that?
Bravehearted Voices is brought to you by the Ministry of Deeper Christian in partnership with Ellerslie Discipleship. Our passion is to help you grow spiritually by providing Christ-centered resources, discipleship, and training in the Word of God and the victorious life of Christ. Our agenda is to bring back the stuff of old, the sort of Christianity that is lived out with the gusto of heaven and actually and practically works. For more, visit BraveheartedVoices.com.